See Bon Iver live at All Points East. Don't miss Bon Iver live Sunday, the 2nd of June at Victoria Park, London. With special guests Mac DeMarco, First Aid Kit, John Grant, Ezra Furman, and many more. Tickets available now at allpointseastfestival.com.
G'day there, my name is Mike Goldman. Welcome to On The Mic. Look, it's comedian Rob Brown.
Wow,
he's
here.
Welcome to On The Mic. Great to see you again.
You too, my friend. I know.
It's a long time between drinks, my friend. The last time we did a podcast was in LA at your house.
In my house.
In between gigs at the Comedy Store, the Improv. You know, playing your shows.
Yeah.
Now you're back in Australia.
You've got finally.
Your business, corporatecomedians.com.au, where you're hiring out everyone from Dave Hughes to Akmal Saleh, and maybe
absolutely.
I might get the odd MC job. I noticed I'm not on the website, but we'll talk about that later. And you've got such an amazing life that we didn't really talk about a lot of those years ago in LA.
Yes.
And I was always thinking about, I really wish we talked about Iraq, how you were training the police forces over there. Yeah, crazy. How you had like so many near-death experiences over there and the messed up stuff that happened. You lived in a caravan park.
Yeah.
And of course, playing all those incredible comedy shows over the years. So,
yes.
Dude, there's a lot going on in Australia right now as well, which we need to talk like that. We just watched the Pauline Hanson documentary. I only watched part two. You watched part one. And like they're selling us out to the NRA. They're trying to get guns in Australian crazy people's hands again so we can have more massacres. It's like, what is going on?
Well, I love that Pauline's interview last night where she said, her statement where she came out, she said she has never, ever accepted funds from the NRMA. And and you go, oh, clever. I see what you did there.
Exactly. She's tricked us all.
But she's onto it.
Not even for roadside assistance.
No, nothing.
Anything like that.
It's like when Abbott said he wasn't going to cut funding to the ABC or SBS. He didn't. He cut it to the ABC and SBS. So, you've just got to listen to what they're saying. Listen to the words.
If you haven't watched this documentary series on Al Jazeera, it's two episodes, and I believe they have a little bit more footage. Do yourself a favor and just see. If not, you're against Pauline Hanson or One Nation or whatever, just watch it to see some behind-the-scenes dealings between political parties. And one of the biggest donators to political parties in the world, the NRMA, the NRA, and see how dodgy these guys can be with the reasons behind wanting all this money. And you just told me before off air that apparently Pauline was saying, I want to see all the footage.
Yeah, Pauline Hanson has come out and said this is nothing more than a hit job. She's been, tricked into revealing what sort of a monster she is, and she's not gonna stand back and cop that. And she said they wanted all of Al Jazeera's 3 years worth of footage and data released, and Al Jazeera said, I don't think they want that, but we'll do that. And so that'll be concerning.
If you're watching anywhere else in the world, Pauline Hanson, she's a right-wing politician. She used to own a fish and chip shop in Ipswich and decided that there was, back then, I think it was too many Asians in Australia taking over.
Yeah, they were the fear.
And there's like the Muslims are taking over.
Yep.
Politicians are all dodgy. It's all the fear tactics. And now she's just been busted in a sting set up by Al Jazeera.
Yep.
That had a hidden camera. They even made up a gun association guy to actually infiltrate One Nation and make out, yeah, I want guns. I'm going to introduce you to the NRA. And that guy, wow, that's commitment.
But for
3 or 4 years pretend to be a shooter and loving
a gun
guns,
advocate,
get in there and dangle the carrot. I mean, One Nation, I mean, they'd probably be struggling for donations as it is. But for some guy to come in and say, hey, you want to get some millions? I reckon I can get it through the NRA. I want to see more of it because it's so addictive watching it last night and just being the fly on the wall. I mean, I've worked on a few shows where you're a fly on the wall and you get to listen to people's conversation when they forget the cameras are on. These guys didn't know. And the things that they say are just shocking. You haven't seen part two.
No, I haven't.
Of this series. And the big tall dude with the glasses, he's the Queensland politician.
Steve Dixon.
Yeah, I think it's his name. He's talking about, oh, I can't wait to get in my big house and just have every gun imaginable and just fire them off into the ocean and kill anything that comes near my house to protect myself.
Yeah, it sounds stable, doesn't it? It sounds like a mentally stable person you want representing you.
Unbelievable. And just when they're having the meetings with the NRA and the NRA saying, oh, we want 4 or 5 articles a week, you know, as long as you've got like a journalist who's... This is in episode 2 that you haven't seen yet. A journalist in your back pocket that we can feed the stories to and they can just print them. But it'll be under the journalist's name.
Right.
Because they... And this is what the lady said. Because they don't have time to do all the research and write this stuff. So we'll write it for them and we can just... you know, make the donations to make this stuff happen. And they're talking about if there's a massacre, the things that they say to...
Yeah.
And then they're saying, you know, give them an inch. You know, they'll take a mile, so you don't give them one gun. And you guys have got a lot of work to do. And
yeah,
it's so full on.
Well, I think what it highlighted for me was that the NRA has come out and said throughout in the first series, they came out and said, you know, Australia is... It's not a good example for us because everyone keeps throwing it up in their face that we had we've had more than one massacre. We'd had a few massacres.
Yeah,
Port Arthur was the worst the world had ever seen by a single gunman in a non-wartime period. And he killed 35 people. It was 1996. And regardless of what you think of Howard, he implemented a policy that has resulted in zero massacres since then.
Yeah.
So zero. When you consider America... had almost one a day last year, and a mass shooting is more than four, you know, more than four people killed.
Yeah.
We haven't had one of those in 30 years. Mm. Oh, sorry, in 20-odd years.
Mm.
America has more than, close to one a day.
Yeah, my godfather was in the Liberal Party back then, and there was a lot of people. He was actually, his electorate was Queensland, halfway down the Gold Coast.
Yep.
And he had a lot of people contacting his office saying, you know, this is a joke, you know, they can't take my guns away, you know, stuff you'd expect. And he was like, this is it, you know, we're not going to get in this election. And they just made it by the skin of their teeth. And that's a ballsy move for a politician to...
Well, Jacinda Ardern has just done the same thing in New Zealand, you know. She hasn't dilly-dallied, she hasn't, you know...
She's copied our lead.
She's just gone, she's gone, well, that works, that'll stop this.
Do you think, well, if we didn't have those gun laws, then maybe that guy, we don't want to say his name, would have come over here and committed the atrocities in Australia.
He would have done them here. Yeah, exactly. Look, the reality is that we have not had a massacre since the banning of semi and fully automatic weapons and military style rifles. So we banned those and we haven't had a massacre since.
Yeah.
Now, in the first episode, the One Nation guy, Steve Dixon, I think his name is, he came out and was telling the members of the NRA and anyone else that would listen that in Australia it's horrible.
Yeah.
The violence here is just out. There are people having Africans break into their houses with baseball bats and beating them to death.
Yeah, but no one was beaten to death with a baseball bat.
No.
So was a couple, someone got their car stolen.
Yeah.
I think.
Well, which is like
there was no guns.
No one died.
No,
there was no massacre. Well, I mean, and we've had horrible things happen, you know. But you know, people go, well, what if you ban a knife next? What do you ban knives next? What do you ban cars next?
Ban fists. Your fists are banned.
Well, but look, the problem is this: is that cars and knives and other baseball bats are not designed to kill people.
Mm.
In fact, car manufacturers go to a lot of expense to prevent the deaths of people, you know? So a gun, if used correctly, if you follow the instructions, you should kill someone.
Yeah.
Or something.
And something else that they were saying in the doco last night, we never talk about, you know, taking weapons off people. You're going to lose your weapon. We say, you know, you're not going to be able to fish or hunt. You know, we talk about fishing and hunting. We don't talk about having a weapon or taking your gun away from you. It's just for hunting and fishing.
Yeah, it just depends what you're hunting, you know, pigs or deers or people.
Anyway, you got to watch it because you see what a bunch of horrible people the NRA are.
Yeah.
And how all they care about is money Anyway, watch it. It's an eye opener, that's for sure. And I really think that it's not going to take too many seats away from Pauline Hanson and One Nation, because you know they really their fans have dug their heels in, and she hasn't even watched a documentary herself.
Yeah, I don't. I find that a little hard to believe. Mm. And I think you're right. I think that Pauline Hanson's fans or One Nation fans are pro gun for the majority, for the most part. They are anti immigration for the most part. They are anti-Muslim for the most part. You know, I think that's so there's nothing you know, if Pauline Hanson had slipped out that she actually wants to care for people, that may have lost her some votes. You know, if she said she actually wants to increase the minimum wage to allow people opportunities to actually live in this country, then no, that would have certainly cost her votes. No, just plain old hate and fear. Well, that her base love that. They live on that.
Do you know, it also watching that makes me realise, even more so now than ever, we need a political overseer like we have in state government. Like, we have the Independent Commission Against Corruption. You know, it's put people like Eddie Obeid in jail for giving out contracts to family members. And, you know, it's just a warning and a deterrent for people that are going to do the wrong thing. Like, I mean, Malcolm Turnbull giving $200 and something million to one of his mates who used to work at Goldman Sachs, who's now overseeing the Great Barrier Reef, that didn't even go out to tender.
Yep.
I mean, so that kind of stuff needs to be controlled, and we don't have that in a federal level. Karen Phelps is someone as an independent who's been pushing that, and there's a few other people in the Senate that mentioned it, but it's just not happening. So hopefully that happens on a federal level anyway.
Yeah, and I don't get me wrong, I have nothing against Karen Phelps, but let's not think she's just some grassroots lady in the burbs that came out of nowhere. She had some pretty big backers and is very, very conservative in her views, and her constituents are conservative, and her funders are certainly conservative.
Mm. I noticed she hasn't really talked about that overseeing the government thing that she was doing before. So I'd like to see that actually happen.
Well, it depends what her donors tell her to say.
Yeah.
And this is the problem. You start taking large sums of money, you're indebted to them.
I didn't see a lot of ads for her. I mean, she did take over some press conferences, but that was supposed to be a Liberal press conference, and she was just there, and the Liberal guy knew she was there and didn't want to get into a debate with her, so he snuck off, and she thought, all right, my press conference now.
Yeah.
And I mean, she had a lot of volunteers. I met a lot of them when I interviewed her. People working for free that were, you know, just out there because they believed in what she was doing. And she's got a great history, you know, being the head of the Australian Medical Association. She's someone who's got a brain.
Yeah. Oh, she's certainly, you can't deny the woman's intelligence.
Yeah.
I think she has an agenda. Hmm. I think she certainly has a lifestyle she needs to protect. Yeah. But I think her primary, what got her across the line, which would have I would have happily voted for, was the fact that she wanted to be humane to immigrants who are unwell in detention centres that we've built for them.
Duck in detention centres.
I don't know anyone that would be against that. Well, yeah. I do, but I don't know how people are against offering welfare to those in need. I don't. But this is what's come. That was her platform. I'm going to give healthcare to those we have in detention and have had for years. And people went, yeah, good.
Well, let's talk about quickly your, because this is what I wanted to start with, you know, rather than getting all deeper political straight off the bat.
Yes.
You've got this amazing company called corporatecomedians.com.au, and, you know, you're performing every week, and one day it might be for an accountant firm, and one day it might be at the comedy store or somewhere like that. So
yeah, I'm doing the company came as a result. I came back from the States. I'd been there for a bit over 3 years, and I came back, and the scene was really it was very club based, you know, and there didn't seem to me to be anybody really specializing in comedy for corporate and private events in Queensland, especially where I'm based. So, look, the advantage I have is that I've been a comic and in this industry for 18 years. You know, I remember in 2009 I was in Edinburgh with Will Anderson, and I performed on the stage together at a show called Late in Life, which was a bear pit, and I worked there with Dave Thornton as well. And so I've known, and I work with a lot, and have worked with a lot of really good comics, you know, and Dave Hughes and Fiona O'Loughlin, and so I know all those people. So it became a lot easier for me to run a company where I was promoting basically people I actually respected and, yeah. and enjoyed the comedy of. So that's what I started doing. And I'm not, I don't manage anybody, so I don't have a vested interest in who, if you, if I give you five or six people to choose from and you pick one, it doesn't matter to me, you know?
How hard is it when you're a comedian, you know, you go and play the comedy clubs and, you know, those people are going there to laugh. But when you show up in front of a group of people that might hate their job and, you know, some people are there because they love their job and then some people are having inter-office bullshit going on and then you show up and you've got to try and make these people laugh. You might have just had a had their CEO on talking about how the company's turned to shit.
Yeah.
How do you get a room full of people like that laughing?
Well, I think you've got, look, sometimes you've just got to play with what you've got. Yeah. You know, I remember doing a gig years ago now. And before I went on, the guy from head office was in talking about workplace health and safety and was running through the numbers of slips and falls, traffic accidents, overhead injuries. A whole range of different things, right? And then at the end of this thrilling account of morbidity, they go, now it's time for the comedian. So my intro. So I've come out, I've gone, wow, ladies and gentlemen, thank you. Just quickly, just checking your fatality bingo card numbers again. Those numbers were 23, 16, 8. That got a good laugh. So sort of playing off.
Oh, that's good. So you go, oh, that was really horrible. But now forget about that crap. I'm just going to tell some stories.
Yeah. The worst I ever had, I was performing in Brisbane. I was about to go on. The MC's come over and gone, okay, Rob, you ready to go? I went, yep, ready to go. He jumps on stage, goes, ladies and gentlemen, if I can get your attention, please, if you all come and sit down. Just quickly, some bad news. Peter Brock's just died.
No, just before you're going on.
Sad news. Mm. Anyway, ladies and gentlemen, please welcome to the stage the comedian, Rob Brown. And I knew on that day that Pete wasn't going to be alone in his death. I knew.
If only you thought of that line right then.
Oh, I knew it right then.
You just didn't say it.
I didn't say it. No.
I just got to go, thanks. Well, I would love to have seen your face.
I couldn't believe it. I'm just going, are you shitting me? Like, really?
People don't even think.
Couldn't you say that afterwards? Like, because people were, we just lost an Australian sporting icon. Yeah, they didn't. Care about my dick jokes.
You've had some pretty amazing gigs, though. I mean, playing the Edinburgh Festival was that
Edinburgh like? Festival was amazing. That was loads of fun. Getting to work with, and I say this to people. I think it's easy for me to say I'm not the best comedian in the world because I've worked in and around the best comedians in the world. Mm. You know, I've seen them. I've seen what they do. I've seen the work they put in. I've seen the effort. And I was prepared to do that. You know. A lot of people think comedy is a fast-flowing where we all get together at night and laugh and joke and poke. It's just one big fraternity. It's not. It's an extremely lonely profession. It's something you do predominantly on your own and all over the country. So you travel on your own. You perform on your own. You go to hotel rooms on your own. It's not that glamorous. Mm. It's a great job. Don't get me wrong. But there would be days when I did the UK in 2011, and I was there for 40 days, and there were times when I wouldn't speak to another person until I was on stage. You know, like I would just be traveling and driving.
How bizarre!
Yeah, it's weird. You think it would be this great club? It's not. It's not a great club.
Are comedians normally, you know, when they're not on stage making everyone laugh, are they a little bit depressed? Is it a depressive kind of personalities or?
Well, look, I like comedians. Like people go, oh, this comedian's always on. I go, well, good. I love funny. You know, I don't want the dude that's off. Get that guy.
Is there
away
yin
from
and
me.
Yang? Is there like a?
There are some. There are
some comedians I know. They're like, you know, very serious and dark. But when they get on stage, they're hilarious.
Yeah. Oh, look, Chris Wainhouse is a standout for me. I think he's probably one of my favourite comics in Australia. His ability to grasp what's in front of him and make something funny is great. And he and I toured a lot in New Zealand.
I've never heard of him. Is he any good?
Yeah, he's all right.
No, he's watching this. He'd be watching this.
He goes all
right. He was my writer on Big Brother. He was brilliant.
Yeah.
Really good. He's a good comedy writer.
He's a great comedy. Luke Heggie is another guy that I'm really liking at the moment. I think he's doing some great comedy stuff.
You and Chris used to have this newsletter that you bring out every day that radio stations have subscribed to called Be Funny.
The Be Funny, yeah.
And I used that every day. It was great. Really good. I wish that when I was on radio, that had something like that earlier. That's a great idea.
Well, look, I think it's... look, the problem is people don't want to pay for it. Mm. That's it. And then you listen to breakfast radio now and you go, oh, okay, maybe you should pay for it.
So if someone's having a party and they go to corporatecomedians.com.au and yep. they want to hire Dave Hughes or they want to hire yep. you or someone, I mean, how long do you play for and how much does it cost to hire a comedian?
Look, the one thing that always comes up is when you start asking people, look, let's get a comedian, the first question is, well, how much are they? And B, where do I go to get one? How much are they? Look, you're looking at a starting price for a comedian to turn up to an event, a good comedian to turn up, is about $1,500. That's sort of your starting price. And they'll do between 20 and 25 minutes. Now, I know people get 25 minutes. That's longer than an episode of Friends. Mm. You know what I mean? And there's a reason that we do that long is because that's kind of the best attention span for people.
Mm. Yeah.
Because most people aren't going to an event to see the comedian. Now, if Dave Hughes was coming to Brisbane and has a festival show, people will sit and listen to Dave for an hour and a half. They're ready for that. That's what they're there for.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But if Dave just turns up at an event, now they'll probably happily listen to Dave for an hour still, but he would just smash it out of the park in 20-odd minutes and people would go, how good was that? That would be a highlight. It would be...
Get all your best gags at once.
Yeah, you just fill it up. And it's a great way for companies and organisations to transition during an event. So usually you'll start an event with a lot more of the formalities... awards and speeches and all that sort of stuff. And then you have a comedian at the end of that and then you've sort of switched over now. You're now into a more fun mode. It's a great way of transitioning between events. Comedians as MCs, I think, make great MCs as well because they have that ability to actually entertain the crowd for you.
Hmm.
You know,
oh, especially if they've got good improv skills.
Great. I mean,
because there'd be some comedians that could probably just do their routine and leave, but you know.
But if you've guys like yourself, guys like Lawrence Mooney, those sort of people, and there's heaps more. But those kind of guys can actually just think on their feet.
Yeah.
You know. Plus, they have a shit ton of material.
Yeah.
That they can call on.
You know, any time. Yeah.
I did a gig last year for a company. It was the second time I did their MC'd their event, and they had a whole heap of dramas with the audio-visual stuff that's constantly breaking down and falling apart. And they go, Rob, can you fill in here? So I was doing 5 and 10 minute bits throughout the night while I did this sort of stuff, which created the appearance of it being kind of seamless, when in fact it was far from seamless.
Man, I've had that happen a few times. I remember when I was at Hamilton Island, you know that big place that's shaped like a boat, the big clubhouse there on the water where they finish a lot of the Hamilton Cup yacht races and stuff like that. So they had fireworks going off when they announced my name and I walked onto stage and all of a sudden the fire alarm started going off and sprinkler systems in certain parts, of, not in the room where we were, but out the back. And it's just like, and I'm like, what do I do now?
Yeah,
so I just started breaking out into a rap with the beeping.
Yeah.
Yo, everybody, welcome to the show. Great to see you. My name is Mike. This is how I go. And it just sort of, and everyone's like, clap your hands, everybody. And they're clapping along to the fire alarm. These people could die. And they're just clapping along to their impending death. But you've got to improv. You just got to make it up as you go. And it makes the night run so much smoother.
Yeah. I mean, look, there are a lot of really snappy, smooth MCs out there that are super pro. And if everything's going well, they're the ones you want, you know? But if you're looking for something, if you're looking for an MC that's going to make your event better, I think a comedian or someone with some real skills, other than just MCing and reading a piece of paper, can have. So that excites me. That and I love doing that. I love those sort of gigs. And I did a gig last week before for 1,600 Irishmen on St. Patrick's Day.
Oh, you got to be good for the Irish. They're supposed to be the funniest people.
They are the funniest people. Man, that was 1,600 people in a room is a lot of people.
Yeah.
It's very hard for them not to be talking. And it takes a few people talking to sound like a lot of people are talking.
I find it's best when that happens in a room because, you know, I've done some massive events. You just got to sort of you sort of feel where the areas in the room where they're talking too much.
Yeah.
And you just go, hey, nice hairdo. Look at this guy. Stand up with this guy in the suit. And then all of a sudden they're loud over there. Oh, look at this young lady. Oh, what's your name? Everyone say, hi, Susie. And I go, oh, cool. Now I get your attention. But you've actually got to go there and slap them around a bit.
When I say, hey, quiet, I mean you. you with the hat. Yeah, you.
Yeah, but you can take things too far when they don't shut up. Like one of the hardest gigs I ever did was for Australian Hotel Awards it's the Australian Bartenders Association Awards. So you basically got, you know, publicans and, you know, bartenders all there from different bars all over Australia meeting up at the Hilton Hotel in Sydney. First year I hosted it, I knocked it out of the park. It was great. The second year, they started a little bit later and they were all on it. And it was just couldn't get them to shut up. And I was like literally had to rip into them to get them to shut up. And they didn't get invited back.
Oh, look, it is. Look, sometimes, you're right, sometimes you've just got to accept that this is what it's going to be and you just do your job the best you can. And but yeah, it's amazing.
When did you decide to get into comedy? How did that come about? Because you've had such a crazy juxtapose in your career to like, you know, death and horrible things happening in the Middle East. And is there a moment when, look, I enjoy laughing rather than death?
Well, I started. I worked in prisons in Brisbane for 10 years. So that was. I left that, and my wife and I at the time bought a coffee shop in Forest Lake, and so it was while I was there. I had a friend of mine say to me, you know, Rob, you should do comedy. You should do it. You should do it. Had been saying it for a long time, and I said, all right, well, look, you. In the end, I said, you organize a gig, and I'll turn up. And about a month later, he goes, I've got you a gig. So I had to do a 5-minute spot in a pub in Brisbane. I can't even think of the name of it now, but I jumped up and I did my 5 minutes and it went really well and I just fell in love with it. I just went, this feels really good.
You nailed it?
I was comfortable. Yeah. I did my 5 minutes and I was comfy. You know, I was very lucky that there was a couple of different things that happened. I started sort of doing comedy just before there's a Raw Comedy competition that happens annually where they get new and up and coming.
Oh, yeah, Triple J Raw Comedy. I did that back in the 90s.
Yeah, yeah.
I showed up and Greg Sullivan was in the crowd. You know, he's a Brisbane comedian. And you know when your first time getting up there and you hear that first laugh? The first laugh I heard when I got up on stage and did a couple of jokes was his.
Right.
And he's just got such a loud laugh and it just felt so good. It felt I was having a warm shower in the middle of Antarctica.
Yeah.
He was great.
Well, he was talking about him. He, after Raw, I got third in Queensland for Raw that year. And then shortly after that, I got offered a writing job for radio at River.
That's where it came
out. That was through Greg Sullivan and him and Dean Miller.
Yeah, cool.
So I was only in radio for about a year. I didn't like it. It was, it's a weird industry, radio.
I've worked in radio since I was about 15 and hosted national shows, filled in for Kyle Sanderlands and Triple M and Today FM, and I've worked at all of them. And radio is such an incredible place to get your start in the media industry.
Yeah, yeah.
Especially when you're in regional areas. Like I worked in Taree and I had to be the newsreader, I had to do the night announcer, be the night announcer. I had to do the breakfast show and even go out and do sales. I had to run the freaking weather station.
Wow.
They, you know, like a lot of country stations, they have this box out in the backyard and you got to go out there every hour. You put on a long song like Guns N' Roses, November Rain, goes for 8 minutes, 36 seconds. And you got to go out and check the barometric pressure. You got to type it into a computer. You got to check the that precipitation. You got to write that down. You got to look at the clouds and match them up with photos in a book and go, yep, that's a CL1. Yeah, type that in as well. Still weirdest thing, but it's a great place to get your start and learn how to do a lot of different things.
Well, even River, which is certainly, I wouldn't call, well, I suppose it is regional, but it didn't seem like it.
Well, they used to be, before the River, though, years ago, they were the number one station in Brisbane.
Yeah.
Yeah, when they were 4IP. Yeah, my dad was a radio announcer there.
Yeah, 4IP was what it was called.
And,
yes.
And Grant Goldman and my this is another story, my later on stepdad, David Joel, who is also my godfather. That's
a whole different
podcast. So what we're saying is radio is quite insular, incestuous.
You're either born into it or you're not allowed.
How did you go from that stage of you know, when you go, okay, I'm going to make this a career.
Mm.
I'm going to, you know, you got the job at River, and obviously that's a moment in time where you go, hey, cool, I'm going to make money out of this. And yes. how did you explore that and go, you're just doing constant gigs every week?
Yeah, look, if I'm honest, I got the opportunity far too soon. Mm. So I got the radio job before I really had enough skills or material as a comedian to actually take any sort of advantage of it. I was writing a lot more, obviously. I was writing a lot more materials and I was performing a lot. If I was given the position today, I think I would have been able to exploit it a whole lot better. And by exploit, I mean take advantage of the position. I wasn't doing 40-minute shows. I wasn't doing... I didn't have 25 minutes of material. I just didn't have it.
You know? Where do you think you got your sense of humour? Because I know that you had a bit of a time in your life where you lived in a caravan park. Yep. Or did you grow up in a caravan park?
No, we lived in one for a short while. Yeah. I think comedy comes from places that are pretty dark.
Yeah.
My daughter read a tweet the other day that said someone was saying, I hope my child has their childhood screwed up just enough so they're funny. You know? And and I think that's the reality. Most comedians come from pretty screwed up pasts. The funny ones, anyway. I think tragedy is the flip side. It's where we get our comedy from. When things go bad, if our ability to laugh at it is pretty important.
You'd have to have a good sense of humor. You know, going through some of the things that you went
through.
Yeah,
I grew up with an abusive alcoholic father who ended up becoming a drug addict. There was a lot of horrible stuff that happened in the house.
And aside from where you grew up, I mean, you've seen some messed up stuff in the Middle East and working in prisons as well. Mm. So you've seen, you know, some fairly dark sides to the world. And I guess it'd be hard to not sort of take that on board when you're working around it every day. And so when all of a sudden you're doing something that's fun and it makes you laugh, you might go, whoa, where have I been?
Yeah.
What have I been doing?
Yeah, well, I love comedy. The reason I got out of comedy for that short period, my wife and I separated. It was a horrible time for me. And a mate of mine said, "Hey, I've got a job if you want it." And he went, "Look, I have a position at a training base. I've got a degree in justice from QUT, and I had my prison background." He said, "Look, we're training Iraqi national policemen in Iraq, if you're keen to be a part of that." And I went, "Yeah, get me out of here." So I went over there for 18 months. As I said, we trained 22,500 Iraqi national policemen. And that 18 months gave me the space and the finances to be able to sort of look after myself and get back on my feet.
Mm. Was it dangerous over there?
Yeah. 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 You seen the papers?
Yeah, no, well, I mean, where you were training. I mean,
No.
I mean, were you in the green zone, is what I'm talking about, or were you out there in the wilderness?
We were about 3 hours drive south of Baghdad in a place called Arn Numania. It was built by Saddam and the Iraqi government they built these cities that were vacant, they weren't finished. But they were training buildings for soldiers and stuff to go up and down, and we used those facilities down there. So that was pretty wild. Driving around in Baghdad was probably the most dangerous. We had a situation one night. We were we were coming home back from Numania back to Baghdad, and we were three vehicles in a line, and the first vehicle had actually run over an explosive. Thankfully, no one was injured, but the vehicle was immobilized. So the four guys that were in those vehicles crossed over into the other two, and we headed off back into Baghdad. Well, about 20 minutes after that, well, 15 minutes after that, in the vehicle I was sitting in, we were hit with an RPG, which is a rocket-propelled grenade. Someone's fired that at our truck from the side of the road, and it's gone straight in opposite me. It went straight through the guy sitting opposite me, and exploded between me and the guy next to me on my left, and unfortunately it took his head off basically, and that was pretty harrowing. Yeah, that was.
So what you're saying is it was dangerous?
I'm saying it was dangerous.
Yeah. Fair enough. Like how do you handle a situation like that? What do you do? I mean, you've got all this training, and all of a sudden the guy's head next to you blows off.
Look,
I mean,
somebody asked me the other day, why do some people get PTSD and some people don't? And I really believe it was the fact that I grew up in a very dangerous home anyway. Mm. There was a lot of danger there. So my threshold was
pain.
I get some sort of inoculation. I've got some type of immunity to certain levels. It was still horrible.
Yeah.
You know, and I'm not saying I became a hero. It was scary.
Did they catch the guy that fired the RPG or?
No, we didn't stop. We were thankfully able to keep driving. I returned fire out of the back of the vehicle, but I never saw anyone. I was just firing out the back to just
deter them from coming to shoot you anymore.
Again, you know, because it must have surprised them because it's gone. It basically went in. We're not sure how it didn't activate, but the RPG didn't
blow up.
No, it blew up on the way out, not when it.
So it took this guy's head off, clean off, and then.
Well, it went straight through the guy. So it went through the side of the vehicle, straight through the guy sitting in front of it. And then it's come up, and as it's breached the vehicle, it's exploded, and the shrapnel has come back and killed the guy sitting next to me. So it's just showered, you know, and I'm just sitting there.
Do you get any shrapnel or anything?
I got some shrapnel and stuff in my back, and I did break a collarbone, but that was it. Yeah. Like, that was,
you're lucky, man.
Man, it was incredibly lucky. Incredibly lucky.
How did it change you in any way?
The way you
treat life and what you want to do with your life and...
Look, I think the way it changed me, well, if anything, was it made me realise that it's that quick. The two guys that are deceased probably don't even know they're dead. It was that quick. They probably don't even know. Mm. So that's, you know, there was no pain and suffering. There was no screaming. There was none of the horrible stuff, which is a blessing, you know.
Agent Orange, the DMZ, the Viet Cong. You've seen the films, but have you ever heard the real story about the Vietnam War from those who were in country? Grunts from South Dakota, Hanoi housewives, local guerrilla fighters. This epic tale of the world's longest modern war is an unforgettable story of corruption, loyalties, ruthlessness, and misjudgment. It will change the way you see our world. From Max Hastings, Vietnam, out now in paperback, ebook, and audiobook.
But I just feel like it was one of those things that proves how random stuff is, you know. And for the families of those guys, even though it was a lot safer than being a soldier there, you know, we weren't engaging in the enemy. There's a part of your brain that goes, they're in a war zone.
Yeah.
You know, there's a level of fear. Unfortunately, one of the guys that was killed in there had lied to his parents and said that he was actually in Dubai.
No, really? They didn't know. It pays amazing money. I mean, it's quite lucrative to go and train forces.
I think I was on about 11,000 a month, tax-free. So it's not huge. It's not huge money, but when you're a guy that, you know, is used to doing shit jobs and even the prisons wasn't paying that sort of money.
Yeah.
You know, it was, and I was in a position where I needed money and I needed some stability and I needed to get the fuck away from where I was. So, it served my purpose and allowed me to see the world and allowed me to travel.
Mm. Were there any other close calls like that?
No, that was pretty.
Did you drop everything and go, right, I'm out of here, or did you have to stay?
No. Well, I was on my way home anyway, so I went home, and then I was back in country 2 weeks later.
So to never go back again.
I went back.
You went back and you did it more?
Yeah, I went back and did more. Yeah, I think it proved to me just how random shit was, Mike, you know? I didn't get any fear. It confirmed for me that I knew this place was dangerous and that, you know, it's going to happen. If it's happening, it's going to happen. You can't do much about it.
I went over there and did some shows for the troops.
Yep.
Operation Desert Scorpion, I think they were doing it, and the armed forces troops and everything like that. And we went to Afghanistan, Iraq, we're in Talil, we're in Kabul, and we're in the green zone in Baghdad. We went out to the palace near the airport, and that's where the main Australian base is. And we put on a show there, and they caught two insurgents on the camp. I don't know if I've told you this story or not, but so I'm up there pumping up the crowd, doing this like US troops, Australian troops. All right, big show coming up for you. We got Doc Neeson from the Angels. We got some comedians. And I, you know, cracked a couple of jokes about whatever had been happening on the tour, having to wear bright orange vests and there's terrorist snipers around. Probably not a good idea. And then all of a sudden this general got up on stage, started screaming at me like I was, you know, doing some sort of a weird military drill. And everyone's laughing. They think it's part of the show. And he's like snatched the microphone off me. He goes, "Hey, everybody, got to clear out right now. I got two insurgents on the camp." Yeah. And everyone's like, "Oh, okay." And then they all cleared out. And all of a sudden, I'm the only one there with a couple of roadies and we're packing up all the gear. And I'm like, if all the army's gone and there's insurgents on the camp, like, should we be here?
Yeah, shouldn't we be where they are?
So we cleared out and we went back to our rooms and hid under the bed with our bulletproof vests on and helmets, which is the weirdest thing. Gary Bradbury was there too. Okay. You know, Gary, he's a great comedian. And then we got a knock at the door and the guy's standing there and he's holding this this box of like metal and twisted metal and stuff like all this melted stuff. And we're like, "What's that?" And they go, "Is this yours?" We had to detonate it because we thought it might have been a bomb left by the insurgents. It was all of our microphones and DIs and like equipment. The Americans blew it up.
You shouldn't have hid. You should have stayed with your kids. Should have
stayed with our gear.
Jesus.
But it, man, that was an eye opener being over there, that's for sure. Did you have any trouble when you were training the police over there, you know, being from another country?
It was challenging, obviously. I worked with interpreters, so I would work, you know, in a class. And it was always weird because you never knew what the interpreter was saying or doing. So there'd be some days I would come in the class and go, "G'day, everybody. My name's Rob. We're going to be going out to the field today. We'll be doing some entry drills and then we're doing some car searching. When we wrap that up, we're going to have some lunch. And after lunch, we'll be doing some more exercises over in this yard." And I'll make it go, "Dibble, dibble, 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 dibble."
So he said,
"Okay, that's it.
One thing. That's it. Maybe I should learn that language. It's so much more efficient."
"G'day, guys," says everyone, "go." And he goes,
"It talked for like an hour."
I just said hello. That can't be that long. It can't be.
Because a lot of the Australian troops had to train the Iraqi army over there, and they're having a lot of problems with that. But you didn't run into that kind of.
We were a little bit luckier in that regard. And that all came about as a result of poor US decisions to disband the army and disband the police service and just disband everything, which was
because it created a lot of
angry people who are now
didn't
unemployed.
Have jobs.
They're now unemployed.
Yeah, you know? And of course they're going to run off and join a terrorist organization. You got no money, and they get offered money.
Well, when an
and wives and whatever.
When an organization comes and says, "Hey, we'll help you support your family. All we want you to do is whatever," then people will do that.
Yeah.
It's exactly what people will do.
They broke down the infrastructure. I mean, that's what Saddam did. He put people in positions of power or put people in offices, and half the time they didn't even know what they were doing, but they were getting money.
And look, the average Iraqi lived a pretty good life under Saddam. You know, that's... If we hadn't had the US sanctions on their oil and an embargo on their oil, Iraq would have been fine, you know.
Except for when he was, gassing people. And
he did horrible things. Don't get me wrong. He did horrible things. But for the average Iraqi, you know, I mean, but who isn't doing horrible things?
Yeah.
You know what I mean? North Korea's been doing horrible things for a long time, but they don't have oil.
Yeah.
You know?
Just don't meddle in other people's business. I mean, obviously now, years later, we know that we were fed a crock of shit about weapons of mass destruction and
we should never have
gone to Iraq. Should have gone to Gallipoli. There's so many things that we shouldn't have done. Maybe just don't war anymore.
If you want to support the troops, stop sending them to war.
stop killing them.
Yeah, that's how big a fan I am of our troops. I don't want to send them anywhere. You know, I don't think they need to go anywhere. I think it's absurd. It's absurd.
Okay, enough about war.
Yes.
We talked politics, we talked war, we talked about corporatecomedians.com.au. Yes. So when we were in LA,
yes.
I didn't talk too much about the gigs that you're playing there because it's something I'm fascinated about. Because I've been listening to a lot of Joe Rogan's podcast and a few other US comedians, and they're always talking about the comedy store, playing the store, and you know, playing all these other venues. What's some of the big venues that you played in LA? And you work with a lot of other comedians over there, and what was it like?
I played the Comedy Store. I did a gig at the Improv. I did a gig at a club.
What room did you play at the Comedy Store?
I did two rooms. I did the main room, and then I did out the back and upstairs. I think it's called the belly room.
Yeah, right.
It seats about, I don't know, 40 people, I think.
Yeah, what's it like backstage there? Just all comedians all hanging out, chatting, or
yeah, it's
what's the vibe? Does everyone help each other out, or are they all? Is it all?
I was very lucky. My wife had a friend who was a friend with a comedian, and. So I met her and she goes, I'll help you get into the store.
Oh,
so
that's cool.
So she went down to the store, introduced me to the guy that booked it, said who I was and said I was a good comedian. She wouldn't know. She bullshitted for me. And she'd never seen me perform. So she did a huge favor for me, got me in. And he said to me, look, you can come in every Sunday when they have like an open mic session from, I think it's like 6:30 to 7:30. And then they have family and friends, which is staff usually from 7:30 to 8:30. Then after 8:30, it was more pro comics getting up and doing 5 and 10 minutes. So the guys from Weeds would turn up every now and then and do some of the stuff, jokes from the show they were going to do.
And just test it out.
See if that worked or that didn't work. Other comics would jump up and try bits and pieces and just stitch bits and pieces together.
It's such a great place for a comedian to grow their show and work on it, because they can go out and play 2 or 3, 4, 5 minute spots on like a Wednesday night and so many different venues and get better really, really quick.
Look, here's the problem though. Here's the problem is that if you, let's say you follow all the rules and you laugh at the dickhead owner's jokes and you say his wife's pretty and he's got a big dick and he's got a great... But let's say you do all that stuff. Let's say you play the ultimate cocksucker and you become their bestest friend in the whole wide world. You're only going to earn $100 a night, you know? So
yeah,
What's the point? And that's the division between those comics with money and the rest of us. So there's... Also, the pool is very diluted in LA because you have a lot of actors.
Yeah, you just want to get on stage.
Who want stage time, you know, so they'll jump up and do comedy, you know. Some of them are good, some of them aren't, but for them it's about, you know, there's not a lot of Hamlet spots open. There's not a lot of places for them to perform acting jobs.
It's tough in LA, man. There's so many out-of-work actors. It's absolutely ridiculous. I mean, you were over there, you know, when you're not doing your comedy, you were doing TV commercials.
Yeah, I went into acting. I thought, if they're coming here, I'm going there. So, I did a Miller Lite commercial.
Oh, you're in a Miller ad. That's right, yeah.
Miller Lite with Danny Trejo. That was...
With him?
Yeah.
What was he like?
Super cool.
He's the Mexican dude with all the tattoos.
Got that Mexican guy tattooed on his guts.
He's pretty full on.
Oh, man, he was so cool. And he had these two giant Hell's Angel biker bodyguards with him. They were enormous, you know, and I think, why does he need them?
Well, he doesn't need bodyguards. He's a scary dude, but he's not really. In real life, he's just...
He just
looks scary.
Yeah, I mean, look, I think the guy was a former drug dealer who ended up in jail, ended up giving up drugs and alcohol through AA, became a sponsor to a guy who was on a TV show. The guy rings Danny Trejo and says, hey, I need you, can you come here? And Danny's going, oh, fucking no, where are you? And he goes, I'm at the studio. So Danny made his way down there. And the producer saw him and said, can you show him how to box a little bit? And Danny's gone. He goes, yeah, sure. So the guy goes, do you want to be in the film to Danny? He goes, how much are you paying? And they go, well, I'll give you $1,000. And Danny goes, mate, I would have done it for 50. But
$50.
He would have done it for 50. And that was the start of his acting career.
Did he tell you that story?
I saw him do an interview where he told that story.
Did you talk to him much on
set? Very little. I said hello. He said hello back. I said, I like your taco ads. He went, I haven't done them yet. I went, I know. But it was very little.
So that Miller ad, that's a big deal. I mean, to get on a national ad, played in 52 states in America. It's good payday too.
It was unreal. I'll tell you what made it great was that it was what they call a dual national. So it was paid. I was paid for all the networks that played it on the national scale, the states, but also through the Hispanic market, so the Mexican speaking market. So when I did the gig, I was paid $2,000 for the day, and then I was paid $2,000 again for the Hispanic market. So I got paid $4,000.
That's good.
For the one day.
Yeah.
And then I think I ended up making 60 overall.
$60,000.
Well, but I worked all day.
Yeah, you worked all day, man.
It was all day.
Some people have to work a whole week to earn that kind of money.
Some people don't even have to.
But even just doing a voiceover for a national TV ad like that, you can earn 20, 30, 40, even $100,000.
Man, if you get some of the big ads, and this is the thing about, I was very lucky. I was repped by a company called Coast to Coast. That were great, got me into a lot of places. There wasn't a lot of people that looked like me. You think, wow, Rob, LA's full of pretty boys. And, but none that look like me, none as pretty as me. And
for those of you that are just listening to the podcast rather than watching it, he's a big, muscly, hairy man.
Rob's gorgeous.
Oh, he's beautiful.
So it was amazing to get a lot of that sort of work. But I ended up getting three commercials. I got the Miller Lite one, which was the biggest, and then I got a Mercedes-Benz short film. I ended up doing that, and then there was another burger ad that I did that I don't think ever ran, but I got paid for the day. So,
did you have any surreal moments with celebrities over there? Anything really weird? Like, not Steve Jobs. What was his business partner that started Apple?
Wozniak.
Wozniak. Yeah. Steve Wozniak, isn't it? Yeah. I met him backstage at Dancing with the Stars because I had some friends who were working on it, and we're getting along really well. And he was actually putting on a bright orange vest to go ride off on his Segway because he was a contestant in Dancing with the Stars. And just before he did, we were having a chat, and he's wearing this big watch with these huge valves in it. It was a Nixie tube watch, you know, like those old Russian numbers in the tube that used to be on the old computers. I'm like, man, that is a sick watch. Hey, so where do I get one of them? And he goes, oh, yeah, give me the website. And I go, oh, yeah, I'll get online and buy one. Is anywhere in LA you can buy it? And he goes, yeah, but they're not open until for a couple of days. And I'm like, oh, okay. I'll fly back to Australia tomorrow anyway, so it doesn't matter. I'll try and get it online. He goes, here, have mine. He gave me his watch. I'm like, this is like a $1,000 watch or something like that. And just rode off on his Segway. It's such a weird Simpsons moment. And Jesus. Of course, all my friends who worked on Dancing with the Stars, Dana Michelle, Trent Holmes, I think he was on it too. These are people I worked with on Big Brother. They're like, how the fuck did you get the Woz's watch? Well, we've worked with him for months and you just met him. It was just the weirdest thing. Do you ever meet any celebs or anyone that was like, whoa, this Hollywood thing's pretty out there?
Yeah, I met Daniel Tosh, who I'm
a big fan of, he's great. I love that show.
Daniel Tosh. And
does he still do that show?
2.0.
Tosh 2.0 or whatever it is. I haven't seen it for a while.
No, I haven't seen it for a while. I don't have cable.
Wonder where he's gone. He's probably still doing it. There's so many channels now.
Yeah. He'd be doing something similar as well. So I met him. Jason Ross, was it? The
Jonathan Ross.
Roastmaster. Jonathan Ross.
Oh, yeah.
I met him. Very funny guy, lovely guy. Actually, I saw him performing at Gower's Gulch, which was a small open mic room.
Gower's Gulch.
Yeah.
What a weird name.
G-O-W-E-R, Gulch. Mm. It was near Universal Studios. And, it was a cool little room. I saw him perform there. And then I met him again at the LA Improv, which was super cool.
What was it like playing the Improv?
Was just to be in that building, you kind of go, that's kind of cool, you know.
That's been around as long as the Comedy Store, or it's been there for a long time.
It's got to be close. It's got to be close, isn't it? It's got to be close. But I also met. I'm trying to think of the guy's name now. But I was sitting at a pub called Barney's Beanery in West Hollywood.
That's your main hangout.
That was my main hangout.
I think we've been there a few times.
I loved it, and I'm sitting on the patio with a group of American guys that were mates of mine that I'd known for a while, and we're sitting there talking one day, and this powder blue VW pulled up at the lights, and one of the guys I was with yelled out to the kid, because we're just off the street, so it's right there, has yelled out to him, hey mate, lovely, lovely car, what year is that? And the guy yells back, it's a 64 or whatever. He goes, "Oh, it's beautiful." And the guy goes, "Oh, thanks, mate." And then my other mate goes, "Hey, can I ask you why you chose so-and-so instead of so-and-so for the role of whatever else?" And I'm going, "What, who is this?" And he goes, "Oh, you know, she just seemed amazing. She was somebody that I thought would do the role well and was a little outside of what we would have normally picked, but she was great. Wouldn't you agree?" And he goes, "Oh, yeah, man, she was amazing. She was amazing." He goes, "Oh, lights change. All right, guys, got to go. See ya. Bye."
Who was it?
It was Soderbergh. You know the producer, Steven Soderbergh?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
The guy that has made all these super films.
Yeah, and yeah, going, yeah.
We just did an interview with this huge producer at a set of lights in LA. Like,
it was
just drunk
bizarre
guys yelling from a patio. We were polite.
That's one of the cool things about LA. Like the Rainbow Room, you know that bar? It's up on Sunset Strip. A lot of old rock stars go there, and I was there one night, and there's Steve Tyler just hanging out.
Yeah, yeah.
And my drunk mate goes, "Oh, Steve Tyler," and I go, "Wait a minute, I got to talk to him." And he goes and sits near me, has a good old chat, and he goes, "Didn't remember me." But they're talking for like 20 minutes.
So well, Les, my wife, Les, and I, we got married in Steve Tyler's old house. We got it on Airbnb. And,
oh, what? Really?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Yeah,
it was so funny, much incredible history there.
Because we hired the place, and we wanted it for the weekend, so we got it on Airbnb, and they said, "You can't have any parties or anything here." And we gone, "Why would we?" Mm. And so then Saturday night, it was just packed. It was just, the house was pumping. We had a wedding ceremony. We were on the back patio. So the Tuesday, we got a phone call from the owner. "Look, the neighbors have said you had a party here." So we had a few people. He goes, "You had a wedding?" I went, "Oh, mate, that's ridiculous." He goes, "Yeah, I said, I'm glad we didn't have a Halloween party. It would have been reported all the witches and ghosts that we had there." And he's laughing. "Yeah, I know. How crazy are neighbors?" "Yeah. Yeah. See ya. Can I get my deposit back, please?"
Whoops. I was staying with some friends over there, and they were getting all Francis Ford Coppola's mail. Like, he used to live in that house, but he's got to redirect his mail.
Wow.
So he's just running RTS, return to sender, Francis Ford Coppola. Really like the Dracula film. That was good. It's such a fun place. So cool to live.
But so, the only other guy that I used to hang out with regularly was a guy called Nick Swartzen. He's in loads of Adam Sandler's films. He's very funny.
Oh, I think
guy.
Another guy you're talking about.
Very yeah. funny guy. He's a very successful comedian and a very funny guy and a lovely guy as well. You know, just, well, I'm glad he's funny, rich, and not a prick, because that would be horrible. What a combination!
Yeah, cool, man. What else do we need to talk about? I think we've covered everything almost, have we?
I think so.
Yeah, we've chat for a good hour. Anything else we need to plug? When's your book come out? When's your next movie?
Oh, I think you got to write.
Where can people find you online?
I think I've got to read a book before I write one. So. You can find me online at corporatecomedians.com.au. It's the best place to go for me. So,
what about your Twitter, man? You always say funny stuff on Twitter. What
Twitter,
you
know? Yeah. Comic Rob Brown. And that's all my social media, actually. That's Facebook, Twitter, Instagram. Comic Rob Brown, all one word.
So you put it out on everything, all the different...
I try to, yeah.
Yeah. It can be a pain in the ass. I like Andrew Bogut, who plays for Sydney Kings, well, Golden State Warriors at the moment. He, on his Instagram account, he hasn't posted anything, and he's just written in his bio, "I don't do Instagram, find me on Twitter." And it's like, that's all he does. But it becomes hard because there's so many different platforms you got to put it on.
Yeah.
And especially when you're doing a show like this. Like, I put it out on YouTube, Twitter, Instagram, Facebook, on my website as well, because if, you know, you say something wrong or say something bad, you could be shut down, and then all of a sudden you lose all of your episodes for you've been making for the last 5 years.
It's not fair.
It's not fair.
It's hard because it's so many, when you're using so many different platforms, there's so many more different rules, you know, and one thing could contravene another and you end up losing all of it.
Well, are we done?
We are done.
That is it. That's a wrap.
Perfect.
Thank you so much.
Thanks, brother.
Comic Rob Brown, my good friend.
See you soon.
This is Acast Recommends. Every week we pick one of our favourite shows, and this is one we think you're going to love.
Hi, you lovely listeners in podcast land. I'm Lydia Bright, and I have a podcast with my family, The Brights, the liveliest family in Essex.
Are we going to get entertainment? I thought maybe we could get like a little DJ person to come in and do like a little set.
I was thinking more like butlers in the buff or a Chippendale.
Search for The Brights Podcast now on Acast, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your podcasts.
Acast is home to the biggest podcasts from the UK and around the world. Subscribe to this show and hundreds more now via Acast or wherever you get your podcasts.